This is Dr. Richard Verone continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Gary Smith. Today is December 19, 2003, and I am in Lubbock, Texas, again on the campus of Texas Tech University in the Special Collections Library interview room. It's about 9:30 a.m. Central Standard Time, and Gary, you're in Shawnee, Kansas.
That's correct.
Before we move on with being back in the United States, you had mentioned to me off the record that you had a few things that you wanted to discuss about your Vietnam experience mm-hmm. that we didn't cover. One of them was a couple of incidents at Tuy Hoa.
Yeah, this is just humorous incidents. We were closing down Tuy Hoa, and the first thing was when Tuy Hoa was active, it was a numerous units there. There was aviation, personnel, finance, everybody. When they decided to close down Tuy Hoa, they sent everybody out of Tuy Hoa mm-hmm. probably a month, 2 months ahead of time. Mm-hmm. They brought a CAV unit in, and I can't remember the CAV unit designation now, but it was just a CAV unit. And then they left the dog handlers. We were it. And we kind of felt like we were the outsiders. We didn't feel comfortable going to their mess hall, didn't feel comfortable associating with them or anything like that. And I don't ever remember anybody having any ill feelings towards us or ever being mentioned. But as dog handlers, you were still MPs, and you just felt like the outsiders. Well, one of the ways to get around this, obviously, you had to eat sometime. Mm-hmm. Our vet tech was also the food inspector for the installation, and he declared at least one can, and I'm not sure, maybe two cans of mm-hmm. Ham as spoiled, or, you know, not spoiled, but couldn't be used for human consumption.
Okay.
It was good ham. But he declared it bad ham and confiscated it to dispose of it. Well, his way of disposing was to take it back to the kennels, and we had ham for, I think it was about a month.
Oh, wow.
And then we had people go down to the village and pick up French Vietnamese bread. Mm-hmm. The Vietnamese rice bread is a very hard bread. Even once you got through the crust, it mm-hmm. was just, the bread itself was tough.
I've eaten it. I know exactly what you're talking
okay.
about.
Okay.
Yeah.
And we ate ham sandwiches with Vietnamese bread and ham for about a month. And then we had sea rats and I don't know. I'm sure we went to the PX. Well, I know we went to PX because I've got a picture of a pyramid of beer cans that's left over from that period of time. Mm-hmm. So guys were drinking a lot of Schlitz, and they made one big, gigantic pyramid of it.
Okay.
Speaking of which, I can remember after we closed down, convoys were getting hit. And it seemed like the supplies that were coming in on the convoys was on a daily, if whatever came in that day was going to get sold that day,
mm-hmm.
Especially beer. Mm-hmm. And I can remember guys used to get upset when Charlie would hit the convoy and the beer supply was interrupted.
Uh-huh.
So we went through that. One of the other incidents while we were closing down was we had the kennel master, the platoon sergeant, said he wanted to have a dog handler and dog in the barracks to guard the barracks at night. Mm-hmm. So we didn't have to worry about Arvins coming in or any other riffraff coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And I shouldn't say the Arvins were riffraff. I don't mean it that way. But didn't want somebody else coming in and ripping off our stuff.
Right.
Slicky boys. We call them Slicky boys.
Who were Slicky boys?
Slicky boys were guys that could come in and steal your radio and leave the music was the old saying. They would be halfway down the street before you realized the music, your radio was gone because they kept playing the music a little bit louder as they were walking away or something. But it was a myth, I'm sure, mostly. But Slicky Boys were Vietnamese that had gotten through the wire or whatever and gotten in and was able to steal whatever they could find.
Mm-hmm.
At any rate, I got tasked one night, which was decent. I mean, I was off. I didn't have to go out on the perimeter. And I was tasked to sit in the or go to sleep in the barracks. And I could go to sleep and leave my dog hooked up to my wrist, and he would watch the barracks and alert us if somebody tried to get in.
Mm-hmm.
My platoon sergeant, as usual with people who drink anything during the day,
mm-hmm.
decided to get up in the middle of the night, and he forgot that my dog was there, and my dog was all black, raw,
mm-hmm.
and he almost stumbled into him and got nailed, and immediately, the next morning, he says, "That's it. We're not doing that anymore." And it was just comical, that fact, the way he reacted. He said, "There ain't no way." And, you know, it scared the hell out of him when he almost got nailed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have 400 pounds per square inch coming down on a body part. That would scare you.
Mm-hmm.
The last thing about closing Tuiwa,
mm-hmm.
We did not know when we were closing Tuiwa. We didn't know until we'd been going day by day.
Mm-hmm.
And each day we'd get up in the morning and, well, is this the day? And you wouldn't know. And then one day they said, "This is it." And so we loaded up our vehicle, got what we could on it. What we couldn't had to be declared as war loss. And we had the dogs and everybody loaded up and was ready to truck out. Here comes a Vietnamese Arvin down the street from towards our garbage dump, running towards main post with a broomstick over his shoulder and a toilet seat on the back of it, on the end of the stick over his shoulder. And it was just humorous seeing this because, you know, you picture the Vietnamese not being very, I don't know, civilized or what. You're thinking that they don't use toilets and things like that. I know in Korea they didn't, but I have no idea what their outhouses was in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But it gave the picture of, oh, God, you know, this is what they think. They're going to be able to tear everything apart, you know, and just, you know, take whatever they think they need.
Right.
And they're not going to use it as is. A touching moment was when we were leaving Tuiwa, all the kids, and again, how everybody found out about this, the kids were lined up on outside the perimeter begging for candy and whatever other things that we would give them. And we were throwing candy and sea rats and anything that we had that, you know, we didn't mind getting parting with.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we closed down Tuiwa.
Okay. Was it kind of bittersweet?
Yeah, it was, because we wanted to get out of there. And it was an end of a, we saw the end of a post, end of a post there. And I think I mentioned, Paul Harvey had mentioned it in his radio commentary. And we were really, well, we were dumbstruck when we got there and found out. We also got told, don't even get off the truck and get to the barbershop. The first sergeant met us at as we got there. He says, "You guys look terrible. Don't even get off the truck. Take me straight over to the barbershop. You guys get a haircut before you come here."
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we had been straggly, and I don't remember if there was a barbershop in Tuiwa and we just didn't hit it or what. I don't know.
But you got cleaned up.
Yeah, got cleaned up.
Okay.
You
said you also wanted to mention something about Bob Hope.
Bob Hope Show. I was selected to go to the Bob Hope Show because I was off that night. There was two of us selected.
Mm-hmm.
The other guy was because he'd been there the longest and hadn't done anything, gone anywhere. And we flew out this is Christmas Day, and I think I mentioned about the monsoons that they ended on Christmas Day,
mm-hmm.
which I thought at that time was like a miracle. Sampan Zone, the China Sea, and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we got down to Long Bend, went into the stadium where we were, Bob Hope show was, and the stadium was down lower than, and it was like in a valley type of thing, and seats were, bleachers were built all around in a semicircle
mm-hmm.
around it, and we were way up high, and it was told to us, you know, the closer you got to Bob Hope, that was because you were combat arms, you know,
mm-hmm.
the combat support guys, you needed this, you're removed from the area because, you know, the combat armed guys deserved it.
Right.
Which didn't bother us, but I really couldn't make out Bob Hope either. I could, you know, I heard his voice and I knew what was being said. I couldn't make out who the females were
uh-huh.
or anything like that. Got a couple of pictures that demonstrate that.
Okay.
But the thing that was really neat, and I'll get tears in my eyes about this, they had gut wagons up at in the parking lot.
What kind of wagons?
Gut wagons. I think we called them maggot wagons. Running Chef. What they were was basically your catering trucks that serve food and drink and
mm-hmm.
soft drinks and chips and stuff. I bought, even back then, I was a Coke. I love Coca-Cola and.
Mm-hmm.
I bought it. You couldn't buy just a couple of single Cokes or something. I think you had to buy a case. That's the only reason I can remember this, but I bought a case of Cokes.
Okay.
And other guys bought chips, who are other soldiers, you know, I mean, not even with my unit and all. And we were sitting up on the stage, and this was probably an early form of tailgating because I was sharing my sodas, guys were sharing the chips and dips, or not dips, we didn't have dips back then, but sharing chips and
mm-hmm.
whatever else they bought. I mean, it was just a good time. It was just a very good time.
Mm-hmm. You were with, do you remember who you were with exactly?
God, I can't remember the guy's name now.
Just the two of you?
Yeah, it was just us two doghammers. I did run into a guy that I knew from basic training.
Really?
Yeah, a guy named White.
In that huge crowd?
In that huge crowd. Well, I ran into him as we were flying back to Cameron Bay.
Okay.
I met him at the airport.
Okay.
Yeah, it was just a real good time,
right.
Sitting around with a bunch of guys and having, enjoying the entertainment.
How many people do you think were at the Bob Hope show?
Oh, God, probably 20,000.
Wow. And you said you couldn't really hear them very well?
No, I heard them really well.
Oh, okay.
That's the only thing. Could not see them well because the distance we were, didn't have any binoculars or anything like that. You know, it never occurred to us.
Mm-hmm.
He was a hero. He deserved everything the United States gave him and more. Got a chance to, almost had a chance to see him in Saudi Arabia, and that kind of blew up. Matter of fact, I was a little PO'd them. One of my guys, who was an E7,
mm-hmm.
got picked to go see the Bob Hope show, and I somehow he was running late or something and missed the ride to get to the show,
mm-hmm.
and I was so pissed. I told him, I said, "I'll drive you there. You
mm-hmm.
need to go, and if you don't go, I'll go."
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was just so perturbed with him, and it ended up he didn't go, and I didn't get to take him. Excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
And but I couldn't believe and but it was a different perspective. I was looking at it as, here's a chance to do something I did back in Vietnam, and here this guy was probably looking at it, okay, you know, it's some entertainment. I had a chance and I missed it. No big deal.
Right.
So
the Bob Hope experience, just taking that time away, I take it meant a lot to you at the time. And
it really did. You know, when I first was chosen and told I was going, which was only the day before, I didn't give it much thought. I mean, I hadn't seen Bob Hope shows on TV before I went to Vietnam. And didn't really mean a whole lot. But once you got there, and he explained everything. And
he explained everything?
Yeah, he explained, listen, I'm making money. You know, he says, but we're going to pan the stage. We're going to pan the audience. And this is for the folks at home. Mm-hmm. And that kind of really, and you know, he wasn't just there to entertain us. He mm-hmm. was there to really give the people at home some hope, too.
Right.
So.
Okay.
And that's about it.
Okay. Do you want to now transition back to our discussions of when you were back in the United States?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me ask you, Gary, about a couple of just general things about United States policy in Southeast Asia, and in particular Vietnam. You were there during kind of the Vietnamization process, as you know, the South Vietnamese were taking over the war and the Americans were withdrawing slowly. What did you think of that policy? Did you think it was a good one? Did you think it was viable?
Yeah, because I thought it was viable because I didn't know what was going on outside my cantonment area. Like I said, in Thuy Hoa, we didn't go off post. We didn't experience the ground fighting, or we didn't, didn't interact with the Arvins. We didn't interact with anybody. And the same thing with Thuy Hoa, our An Son and Cam Ranh base. Basically, we were into our own little world of guard duty and off, and that was it. You would read the Stars and Stripes, and I don't remember the Stars and Stripes covering that much. Or if they, and I'm sure they did, I just don't recall it. I didn't really take an interest. That's probably part of it, too. I didn't take an interest. It's funny, I ran into a guy when I was leaving Vietnam, and he mentioned, and I knew him from basic training also, and he told me, he said, hey, you probably saw my picture in Stars and Stripes a while back. And I said, no, I don't think I did. He says, well, I was in the Stars and Stripes. I said, no kidding. Where were you at? And he says, well, I wasn't where they said I was. And I said, okay. He says, we were in Cambodia. He says, but they said we were in West Vietnam or something. You know, the story was that they were in Vietnam where they're supposed to be, but he said that they weren't. And that kind of, I'm thinking, okay, I'd missed that. And, maybe you didn't get Stars and Stripes every day, too.
Right.
So, I didn't think about Vietnam until I got back. And the Vietnamization until, when the night I got back and I was told that Quan Yon Pass fell. And that, and I'm going, no, that can't be because the rocks guard that. The rocks had Quan Yon Pass. Well, it did. I'm thinking, damn, something's wrong here.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to White Sands Missile Range, New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And
that was your next assignment.
That
right?
was my follow-on assignment. And I ran into a couple of old country boys. And they were really, they'd never been to Nam, but they were conservative. They were interested in what was going on there. We watched the world news a lot. I had a combat vet for a platoon sergeant. So, you took an interest in it and started seeing things not going as well as it should have been. There was, I remember there was battles where losses were quite high.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I took notice of it.
You did make an effort to kind of keep up with what was happening?
I don't know if it was an effort or if it's just it was there, and mm-hmm. The people I was with, we all were interested.
Right. Do you remember how you felt in April 1975 when Saigon fell and the whole thing ended?
Felt like hell. I mean, that kind of made it. Made me feel like it was worthless what we did.
Mm-hmm.
That we lost all those people for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
That we were a failure.
The United States?
Yeah. And I felt sorry for the Vietnamese, the ones that really wanted the freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And we deserted them. Congress wouldn't appropriate the money, wouldn't let us go back in. We said we would be there,
mm-hmm.
and then we turned our back on. And I felt like, we turned our back on our the guys that got hurt, the guys that were killed, and the Vietnamese. And I just, I felt like total hell about it.
How do you feel about it now?
Well, time heals all wounds, and I'm not. Vietnam would probably be better if we had stayed the course and did it the way we did Korea. But I don't think we would have ever done that either. But I think Vietnam's on the right road. I think eventually Vietnam's going to be a free country again. I don't think the deaths that we experienced, I don't think it was a waste now. Somewhere along the line, they made an impact. They made a voice. If it hadn't been for Vietnam, Saudi Arabia, Desert Storm would have never happened the way it did.
What do you mean by that?
Well, this is just insight from an old MP.
Right.
Well,
your career spanned 24 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so you saw the aftermath of Vietnam from the military standpoint.
Well, what I saw, and Colin Powell and General Schwarzenegger, or not Schwarzenegger, Schwarzkopf's book,
mm-hmm.
really cover this. And I hear politicians talking this now about Iraq. We kind of have an exit, plan and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, General Powell had talked about it in his book that we didn't have an exit plan. We didn't have, we weren't executing things right in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Well, bottom line was the politicians were pulling the strings in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
The military wasn't running the war. We weren't doing the right things. I mean, in Vietnam, we go out on convoy or on guard duty.
Mm-hmm.
We were told that you could not shoot until you got permission from higher headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
You, even if you were being shot at, you had to call in and request permission to fire back. Well, now that's a bunch of crap.
Right.
I mean, you're getting shot at. You don't have time to be calling in.
Mm-hmm.
At any rate, we had a better force when we went inside. We had leaders who said, we're running this. This is the way it's got to be run. When we went in Saudi, We had an exit strategy. I mean, it was just a whole lot better campaign. The politicians give you the strategic objective, but, you know, it is up to the military to accomplish that, and they accomplish it the way they have to.
Mm-hmm. You think this is one of the great lessons of Vietnam for the United States?
Yeah, I do, because even now in Iraq, I think it's happening. Despite what the Democrats are saying,
mm-hmm.
I think President Bush is letting the military run the war. And he's not trying to run it himself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an important thing from it.
What other lessons do you think the United States learned in Vietnam? If any, or did they not learn lessons?
The military. Well, you got to get the public behind you, and the press was what defeated the military in Vietnam. It wasn't Charlie
mm-hmm.
or BC, well, Charlie and BC thing, NBA.
Mm-hmm.
It was the press. Even Ted of 68 was a total loss for the BC NBA. I mean, what they did was they exploited the American press, and the American press labeled it as a great victory for the North Vietnam. But as far as everything that I read afterwards, Tet was a total loss. We won it, and still we were labeled as losers.
Mm-hmm.
You got to get the press on your side, and I think what happened in Iraq proves that. We had I can't remember the word for
embedded.
Embedded reporters. Yeah, embedded reporters. I think Saudi Arabia, when we went in Desert Storm and Desert Shield, I think that proved that that too, because we had it. General Schwarzkopf was doing daily news briefings.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, up to that time, I question that one. I think generals have got better things to do. I mean, the Supreme Commander's got better things to do than sit down and give a conference.
Right.
Dwight Eisenhower wouldn't have time to do that. But, you know, that was probably one way of getting the press on your side, you
mm-hmm.
know, so that they feel that they're getting the full scoop.
Mm-hmm.
We had a better quality soldier. One of the things I saw from Vietnam was that we had a good quality soldier during the Vietnam War. I mean, I had no doubt about the quality of the guys I was working with, and I hope nobody had any doubts about me. We were a good fighting force. I think we were hamstrung with all the things that are going on. Can't shoot unless you're shot at. And, the politicians pulling the strings and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But after Vietnam, we got rid of the draft, and we were taking in just anybody and needed a job.
Mm-hmm.
I saw when I went into let me see, this would have been about my fourth assignment after Vietnam. I was over in Germany, I was a platoon sergeant in charge of a physical security platoon guarding nuked storage.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to worry about soldiers smoking dope on duty, mm-hmm. sleeping on duty. They were in towers 2 hours at a time, and I had to worry about them actually being up in the tower smoking dope.
Mm.
I had to worry about malingering. There was days when I couldn't make my commitment to get everybody up there, and I had to borrow from other platoon sergeants.
Wow.
They had to do the same thing with me. And it was a very, guard duty is a very rewarding job. I mean, it's just, nobody wants to be a guard. Nobody wants to do anything like that. Sentry dogs, notwithstanding, because you're working with a dog. You're working with somebody that wants you and likes you. But in Germany, I mean, we had some of the most pathetic. I mean, we lost the entire platoon one time because of somebody. I don't want to snark or squeal, but somebody turned in the entire platoon for smoking dope. And in a matter of one day, we lost the entire platoon and had to pick up the slack with the other two platoons.
Wow.
And we were already working 12-hour shifts then.
Now, did you say that guard duty is very rewarding or not very rewarding?
Not rewarding.
Okay.
It is a – nobody wants to be a guard. I mean, even to, I'm a guard, basically a guard in a jail. I'm a deputy sheriff, and everybody wants to get out on the street and be a cop. Everybody wants to do the glamorous stuff, and nobody wants to be in there working with inmates. And we do the direct supervision of inmates. We don't sit up in towers. We're actually in the modules with them. But again, nobody wants to do that. What I was trying to point out was I had poor quality soldiers over in Vietnam, or not over in Vietnam, but in Germany. I mean, it was pathetic. And Ronald Reagan got into office, and I could see the turnaround when I went to my next unit, which was working with a reserve unit. And that's where I met my wife. And I started seeing a better quality of soldier. I saw training being done. And then when I left there and went to Germany, back to Germany, I was the first sergeant at an MP company. I mean, it was just night and day. I mean, we had a better quality, a better behaved soldier. I mean, it was just, I can't, the night and day is the best I can do, but it was more than that. I mean, I had soldiers in Germany the first time that were accosting women, malingering. They were, I had three guys I had to kick out of the army, and literally I spent my day trying to handle them while I was waiting around for the army to finally chapter them out, than I was handling my platoon.
So do you think all this was a direct result of Vietnam, or the legacy of
I
Vietnam?
I think so, because we went from a no draft after Nam to and not being very selective who we were taking in, to, I mean, Jimmy Carter, well, Jimmy Carter kind of sold us down the tubes, too, in the military. I was in Korea, 76, I think. Yeah, 76, 77. And Jimmy Carter made a comment. We were waiting for a pay raise. And we were waiting for an appropriations bill to be signed, so I was wanting to deroze and go back to the States, and mine was being delayed because the funds hadn't been appropriated yet. But Jimmy Carter made a comment about he was going to veto the appropriations bill if it had a raise in there for the military or a too big a raise. He says, the military doesn't need a raise. They're not in the military for money. I know. I was in the Navy, Naval Academy, and I'm sorry, but I do think the military needs a raise. I think they need to be compensated for their sacrifices and things. And that was the air of how things were back then. And as soon as President Reagan got into office, like I said, you started seeing things change. And I think it was just natural. Looking back now, I think it's natural. Vietnam left a bad taste in everybody's mouth. Nixon got wrongly blamed for Vietnam. Hell, he was trying to get us out of there under honorable terms. And then Watergate really screwed things up. And then you got Ford, who he wasn't in there long enough to do anything. And then President Carter comes in, and I think he mostly came in for a, you know, based on what happened with the Republicans, not just Watergate, but Vietnam. And don't spend a whole lot on the military. We don't need them other than just throw them in a whole and keep them there until we need them again,
mm-hmm.
type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then when President Reagan came in, he says, we need a strong defense. And so I think it's like a pendulum on a clock.
Okay.
It's swung one way, it's swung the other, and I think they even went through that with President Clinton. I think it started with President Bush, the peace dividend after the fall of the Berlin Wall and all. But I mean, the we stood down, and I think we're just starting to realize that we need a strong military.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think Vietnam was part of that.
Okay, so, Gary, what did you think of the anti-war movement?
I was not happy with it, obviously. I really did believe that, you know, we were there to stop communism, and, you know, and if we didn't stop it there, it was just going to progress on and on and on. And I thought the anti-war was more harm than anything. Jane Fonda demoralized people, and the more I hear about what happened to PWs when she went to Hanoi,
mm-hmm.
I will, you know, she's asked forgiveness, and I don't know if anybody can forgive her, but, you know, I just basically won't forgive her.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, these people that were against the war, they're the same type of people as going against Iraq right now. I mean, I agree. Peace is a whole lot better than having war, but, I mean, sometimes you just got to fight. And I thought Vietnam was what we were fighting for was the right thing, and I thought they were wrong.
Okay. Let me ask you about your personal service. Today, looking back, how do you feel about your service in Vietnam?
I am very proud of my service in Vietnam, but I am also, and I forget what I wrote on my thing, I used a word and I can't even remember what it was, but I am kind of...
I'll look for it here while we talk.
I'm proud, but I'm not proud. I wish I had given more and been more aggressive in my duty performance in Vietnam. I felt that, looking back now, that I didn't do enough. I didn't work hard enough. I didn't spend enough time with Rolf. I didn't walk my perimeter as often as I should have. I didn't do things. Something just came to mind about Vietnam, and also I want to mention it.
Absolutely.
When I went to Vietnam, and this is probably standard procedure anywhere you go, when you first process in any unit, they give you a bunch of papers.
Mm-hmm.
They pull them out of your 201 file and say, you don't need these. And being a dumb private, I think I probably pitched mine and said, oh, yeah, okay, I don't need them. Throwing them away. Well, one of them was my diploma from dog school, which I never found.
Oh, wow.
Never was able to get a copy. Two was my driver's license. I was not allowed to drive in Vietnam legally. And when we were closing down Vietnam, or closing down Thuy Hoa, the occasion came, the sergeant says, do you know how to drive a Jeep? And I says, yeah. I says, but I don't have a license. My 348 got lost when I first got here. He says, I'm not worried about that. We're closing. That's Mach Nix. We're closing this place down. Hop in and drive.
Mm-hmm.
But I wish I had been more aggressive instead of just following along with everybody else,
mm-hmm.
what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And at reunions, I don't hear anybody else saying that, and I don't know if it's in the back of their minds. Of course, the ones the reunions I go to, it's mostly handlers from Cameron Bay, and they were more, when we moved to camp back to Cameron Bay, I saw a higher professional soldier there than I saw up in Tuiwa.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that was?
One, probably sergeants that checked on their people, whereas Tuiwa, you didn't see a sergeant except at guard mouth.
Mm-hmm.
There was no emphasis on making sure the soldier was doing what he was supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
It was lax in Tuiwa. Ansan wasn't lax. It was lax, but for some reason, everybody wanted to do what they were supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I don't know. I just don't know why about Tuiwa, but Cameron Bay, it seemed like there was a greater check and balance on things there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, guys that I went to dodge school with that stayed in Cameron Bay were ahead of me on wanting to do, going out and doing their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Another funny event about Vietnam was next to my last night, I had never been in a rocket attack in my life
mm-hmm.
until my next to last night in Vietnam, and I heard a swoosh and a thud. And I was in a POL, I can't remember POL, I think it was POL dump. And I had to call on the radio and I says, what was that? And somebody come back and said, that was a dud rocket. And I had to remake the remark. I says, I'm too damn short for this shit. And, Tuiwa, nothing ever happened, like that. And then, and in Cameron Bay, that was just, okay, you know. Yeah.
Right.
We'll continue on type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay, what do you think was the most significant thing you learned while you were there?
That I could put up with adverse conditions. One moment.
Sure.
I found that I could survive. That I wasn't just a wimp.
Mm-hmm.
I found that there was more strength in me than I had thought. Up to that time, I figured I was just really didn't think I would hold up under adverse conditions. And I mean, after going through the monsoon season, without a dry uniform, freezing in your, when you got off, you went to bed and you shook
mm-hmm.
and shivered, until you finally fell asleep. You were out in the elements, at night. You couldn't stay dry. To me, that was just the most unbearable thing I could imagine anybody having to go through next to, you know, combat and shooting and firing. And I just, you know, I'm thinking, I can do this, and I've done it, I've made it through that, you know, I'll make it okay.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was just the, you know, I found something that I was not as fragile as I thought I was going to be.
Okay.
I think that was it.
Okay. How do you think the war has most affected your life, looking back?
Probably made me stronger in being a conservative type of person, politically conservative, and just who I am. I mean, it's made, I can't describe too much more, but I think that's made more impact on how I ended up where I'm at, in things. I mean, staying in the military was not just because of Vietnam. Actually, it was a platoon sergeant I had in White Sands. But it just, I think I'm more conservative about things.
Okay. Do you suffer any disabilities from your service? To include post-traumatic stress disorder?
No, I don't suffer. As far as I know, I don't suffer anything in the way of PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
I do receive 10% disability from the military for my back.
Mm-hmm.
It's not from Vietnam. It's probably from all the damn rucksacks I carried when I was in training and other places. That's the only thing I've disability that I see out of my military career is
mm-hmm.
My back. And I understand my hearing is not as good as it used to be. So,
okay. Gary, what are your thoughts about Rolf?
Like I said, I wish I had spent more time with him. I wish I hadn't left him there. I don't know. That's a real friend. And I just didn't realize it until after I left.
You don't know the fate of him?
Huh?
You don't know the fate of him?
No, I don't.
Okay.
No. And I don't think I really want to. It's been a long time ago. I know he's dead. And, you know, and that's the end of that.
Do you think about him at all, or do you?
Oh yeah, I think about him quite a bit. I've got right now. I'm sitting here on the floor in my bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have an easy chair in the bedroom,
mm-hmm.
and I've got my my wife's two dogs. There are lots of opposites,
mm-hmm.
and then my daughter who moved from Houston to Washington D.C. Well, when she moved, she didn't have a place picked out yet to hold her two dogs,
mm-hmm.
which is another Lhasa Apso, and then a terrier mixed breed.
Mm-hmm.
So I got four dogs in this house,
mm-hmm.
and right now, until two of them got up and moved away, I had all four of them laying around here with me.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have dogs around, it makes me think about Rolf.
Mm-hmm.
My wife is big on military pictures. We have pictures of myself in different military settings, but she has a patriotic tree downstairs. She fixed it up after last year, after
mm-hmm.
After 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like a Christmas tree, but it's red, white, and blue, and she has pictures of all our relatives in their military uniforms,
mm-hmm.
and Rolf is on there as well.
Huh.
And
that's nice.
Oh, yeah. So yeah, I think about him quite a bit. And then if anybody ever is, if something comes up and mentioned, I'm always quick to say, yeah, I was in Vietnam. I was
mm-hmm.
a dog handler. And, you know, I start describing the fact that I was a sentry dog handler type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I do think about it.
Okay. Would you ever want to go back to visit Vietnam?
I don't know. I don't have an overpowering desire to go.
Mm-hmm.
If I had the opportunity, and yeah, I would. Opportunity and money. We've got my wife would love to go to Ireland, and I think
mm-hmm.
that's the first place that if we ever did any world traveling, we would do.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, if I had the opportunity to go to Vietnam, I would, and it would be to the places where I was at.
Mm-hmm.
And look around. But I think I would probably be sadly disappointed. I'm sure Vietnam has changed quite a bit. I mean, just the time I mentioned that I went back to Oakland on an extradition one time,
mm-hmm.
and I couldn't even see where the Oakland Army base was. I saw places that looked like it should have been the Army base,
mm-hmm.
but it's no longer there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, well, Tui Vaa's probably like that too. And then Ansan and Cameron Bay. So.
Mm-hmm.
But if I had the opportunity, yeah, I had money, I would probably I would opt to do it.
Okay. Have you had any contact with Vietnamese here in the United States?
Funny that you mention it. Yeah, last night I had a prisoner come in, inmate come in. He's a Vietnamese, and just a kid. He doesn't go back to the war years. I've run into several Vietnamese in the jail, and which is, I think, is kind of unusual, because the Vietnamese that I've read about and not really got to know, but the boat people really came over and have taken over our educational, I mean, they excel in education, and that's because the parents really put an emphasis on it, and I think that's really good, and so I'm always surprised when I see a Vietnamese in jail that's in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
My dentist, one of my dentists, is a Vietnamese. Her father was a colonel. I think she said he was a colonel in the Army, in the Arvin Army.
Mm-hmm.
And he suffered under the communists. And she was a boat child. She came over in one of the boats.
Mm-hmm.
She was so young, she doesn't, I don't think she really remembers a whole lot.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But she's done well for herself, and her father really done well.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I see him occasionally. I was married to a Vietnamese when I was in, I've been married three times,
mm-hmm.
and I don't think it's a result of Vietnam or anything else. It's a result of military service,
mm-hmm.
That I got divorced from the first two. Chow, I met her in Fort Knox, Kentucky. She was living there, and I went to Germany. We were married. And instead of being sent right back to Fort Knox, I was sent to Detroit, Michigan, and she didn't want to leave Fort Knox. She had numerous friends there who were Vietnamese,
mm-hmm.
and she did not want to leave those friends. And so we ended up getting divorced because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I've run into Vietnamese quite a bit.
Okay. Gary, if you had to go into the classroom today and talk to young people about the Vietnam War, what would you tell them?
Probably a lot of, probably pretty much a lot of the stuff that I told you about. I mean, I would talk about the humorous things,
mm-hmm.
because I remember that, time heals all wounds type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember too many bad things. I remember the monsoon. I don't know. I would probably talk about Rolf, and the good things, the Bob Hope shows,
mm-hmm.
things like that. Obviously, I couldn't talk about fighting. I mean, the
right.
combat and
mm-hmm.
stuff. I had a guy... I ran into another guy I knew from basic training in Cameron Bay. He was a finance clerk.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really apologetic. I mean, I'm just a dog handler. I'm locked on a base like he is.
Mm-hmm.
And he was telling me, he says, I'm the finance clerk. I'm not going out and fighting. In other words, not going out and doing the glamorous thing of going out and killing and fighting and all that.
Right.
And I had to remark to him, I said, we all have a job here. We're all in danger here.
Mm-hmm.
I said, hell, and that's the one thing from Vietnam I would make sure anybody, when you're in combat zone, you're in danger regardless. The rockets don't necessarily go to the POL dump.
Mm-hmm.
There's always sappers getting through the wire, even if you do have a bunch of dog handlers doing their job. The missile Hussein sent down to, I can't remember the city down in Saudi Arabia, but,
in Riyadh?
Yeah, Riyadh. It hit a barracks. I mean, that was a stroke of luck. Those
mm-hmm.
damn things, those guns were not accurate at all, and he got lucky.
Mm-hmm.
Ended up, we had one of our soldiers out of our unit had been delayed coming over, and he ended up coming over with a reserve unit,
mm-hmm.
and he was the first. I, I don't think he's the first sergeant, but he was going to be one of the their sergeants. And he got injured really bad in it. And, I mean, that was a stroke of luck, the Scud missiles. When you're in a combat, I mean, in Somalia, the second time I've ever been shot at was Somalia.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, through Panama, well, we had mortar attacks there. We weren't in the, in our housing. We were down at the dock, but, mortars, impacted pretty damn close to where we were living at.
Mm-hmm.
And then, went to Saudi Arabia and, you had to worry about the Scuds. We buried ourselves in when the air war started, we had to sit, every night for about the first three or four nights in bunkers underground. I mean, we went underground for 10 out, I don't know, from probably about 9 hours underground, sitting in a bunker, while the air war was going on. And we were way out in the middle of the desert.
Mm-hmm.
But Somalia was the second place I've ever been shot at. And that was, and also friendly fire too.
Mm-hmm. So it was friendly fire?
Well, it was both. It's kind of comical, but I was in what used to be called the University City. And, that was on its, sides of a hill.
Mm-hmm.
And, we were the closest to the perimeter and the, I can't remember what their nationality was. They would receive small arms fire, and they would start firing. And, I mean, the small arms fire was coming in. And I don't remember it actually impacting anywhere near me, but, you know, we were on the perimeter. They were old dormitory classrooms, and we were the closest one to the perimeter. But we had medics behind us, which were higher up than us, and they were firing through our breezeways while we were out on the breezeways firing out into the perimeter.
Huh.
They took the this is comical, and this is active duty guys. They ended up taking the medics' ammunition away from, I think, so they wouldn't be able to fire back for after a couple of episodes of that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we were many a night. We, you know, as soon as it got dark, we would get small arms fire, mm-hmm. and it was a refugee camp outside, and so you didn't dare fire out into the camp. But that's where it was coming from.
Mm-hmm. You served for quite a bit of time after Vietnam, and I would like to just briefly touch on some of these major operations you took
uh-huh.
part in, and you mentioned them in Operation Just Cause in Panama. What was that like in general terms? And what did you do?
Well, I was the comical thing about that. I have to describe this. I just left Germany in 89, around Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
And I had just gotten my family to Fort Meade, Maryland. And I went to I asked to go to an MP battalion because I was hoping to be a first sergeant again.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to the MP battalion, and they says, well, you're not a first sergeant. You're going to be our S2 NCO. And that's an E8 position, which I was an E8. And they says, we're getting ready to deploy to Panama. Matter of fact, we're leaving here in next day or two. Get your family settled, and you can follow along. And the sergeant major made it clear, you know, he says, you're not in a hurry. He says, but we think something's going to happen while we're down there on this deployment. So you might want to, you know, get down there as soon as you can. Well, I'm being the gung-ho sergeant I was. I got my family. I went to the people at government quarters got accelerated their getting into quarters, so I got them into quarters pretty quick. Got my POV out of storage. And I thought I had my family pretty well settled. Now, my wife would disagree with that because it was coming up for Christmas. The whole household goods hadn't come in yet or anything. And I says, well, I'm ready to go. And I got orders to go. The day that I flew out, we had to stop off in Miami and wait to fly on down to Panama the next day. Well, that night I'm in Miami. That's when the Marines were killed down in Panama. Which started the whole thing for Just Cause. Flew down the next day, and everybody's locked down and everything. So I didn't see a whole lot of Panama before that, of knowing what Panama was like.
Mm-hmm.
2 days later, we're in the middle of Just Cause.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody else calls it an invasion. Hell, the MPs were already there.
Mm-hmm.
If... It was a good military operation. It was well thought out. Again, I think, this was something that the military ran it and got it done.
Mm-hmm.
And my part in it didn't do a whole lot other than sit in a tactical operations center and watch the radio traffic coming in and watch assignments going out.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't a whole lot of intel. As a matter of fact, I think once I got down there, I got switched to the S3 for a short time. They felt they didn't really need me in the S2 at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Being a new kid on the block, I really wasn't integrated into the battalion yet, and so I really just didn't see a whole lot.
Okay.
After the conflict was over, start realizing, and it's my first time of smelling death. And do you remember back, they were talking about mass graves?
Yes.
Okay, there was one. And, I mean, we were upfront about it. It was there, and it was near the PX. And I remember being on the bus to go to the PX to get some things, food items or something, and you could smell death.
What did it smell like?
Terrible. I mean, I just can't describe it. I mean, it's just decomposing bodies is the worst damn thing you could ever smell. I don't think there's anything else that's it's worse than that. I smelled it again when I was over in Somalia. After they excavated the site and removed the bodies after the war was over, I mean, that was it was a long time before it was gone. I think it was still there even when I left, but the smell. But Panama was such a depressed area. I didn't realize how bad it was. I mean, I didn't want to see Panama turn over to the Panama Canal, turn over to the Panamanians, because I saw what they did to their railroad. Their railroad was virtually nothing but a rust bucket when we first got there. I noticed there's a railroad line that follows along the canal, and the canals are operating perfectly good. The railroad is sitting there, nothing. Passenger cars just sitting on the rails. Freight cars that are torn and nothing. And all the rails are rusted, so you know that nothing's ever moved up and down for a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was explained to me that we turned the railroad over to the Panamanians. And I'm thinking, well, hell, why would we want to turn the Panama Canal over to them if this is going to happen?
Mm-hmm.
The country was really depressed. I mean, you get downtown, after the war, we had MP stations because we had to train the Panamanian police into being police officers and instead of torturers and oppressors. And the in some of the areas, I mean, they were ghettos. Just squalor. Utter just squalor and depression.
Can you compare that with what you saw in Mogadishu in Somalia?
It was better than Mogadishu and Somalia because because they actually had power, they had lights, they had water. Mogadishu and Somalia, I mean, there was nothing. I mean, the Civil War took everything out of Somalia. When you go into a building and you see the conduits and all the copper wires been pulled out of it, you see all the electrical fixtures that, you know, places where they should have been,
mm-hmm.
and they're not. When you arrive in the country and there's no lights anywhere, except for maybe one little stray light, in the middle of darkness, you know, you realize, you know, there's nothing here. There's a bunch of people. And I mean, you know, civilization, we could live with a lot less lights and a lot less luxuries, but, you know, they had no power. They had no infrastructure in Somalia, whereas Panama had an infrastructure. It was just a depressed area. I mean, mm-hmm. Vietnam was much better than Panama.
Wow.
I never saw anything as bad as Panama in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
The villages, I mean, Korea was better. And, well, Korea was better than Vietnam, too. But, I mean, those two places had to be the worst I've ever seen people living,
mm-hmm.
and what conditions they were living in.
What was your job in Somalia? What was your duty?
Again, I was an S2 NCO. Boy, I never was able to get back into being a first sergeant. And I went to another MP battalion after I left. I went the MP battalion I was in for Just Cause, and then Desert Storm. Then I went to the Sergeant Major's Academy, and then I went to another MP battalion. Hopefully, I was going to get a first sergeant slot. Didn't, and I ended up in the S2 again. So my job was to collect intel and help the intelligence officer collect intel and disseminate it to the units.
Mm-hmm.
In Somalia, there wasn't a whole lot of intel being collected or disseminated. It just we were there as not peacekeepers, but as humanitarian, trying to get the food moved.
Right.
And so intel was things like, watch out for the fish hooks. That's how they're stealing your sunglasses, and be sure and watch out for them so you don't get your eye hooked with one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, coming up, finding out what they were using to pilfer our stuff off vehicles and things, and how to just be careful about things.
Mm-hmm.
The threat wasn't there was deaths over there. You know, once in a while somebody was getting shot and killed, but it wasn't to the stream. When I left out of there in May, we still hadn't had a real major conflict. Nothing like Black Hawk Down.
Right.
It was not laid back, but, you know, it was just, we were there for a humanitarian. We were not trying to do anything. We were not trying to be aggressors.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Gary, let's pause just for a moment.
Sure. All right.
Okay, Gary, let me ask you about Somalia. Do you think that the United States actually accomplished its mission there? When you were there, did you see it as being successful?
I think we were. When we first went in, I was really kind of, questionable about it. I thought President Bush got browbeated into it. He had just lost the election, and he was only doing this because he wanted to have a, I don't want to say legacy. That word seems like it's used a lot. But I felt that he got browbeated by the press into having to do something. do something good.
Okay.
And Somalia came along, and when we went in there, we were helping get humanitarian goods to the humanitarian agencies. Now, after that, you know, the humanitarian agencies, it was up to them to disperse that. And I thought, you know, okay, how long could the military do that? Not very long. I mean, military is purely for fighting, and it's not a peacekeeping force. It's not a humanitarian force. It never will be. Because you got to train to do your mission.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed there till May, and yeah, we were getting the mission done as it was designed. The mission got changed somewhere along the way because when they went after Adid,
mm-hmm.
and they went after rightly so because Adid was doing some, we even had intel that he was doing some pretty shaky things. We knew he was importing cot, which was a drug, and that decimated the country too. But we cannot fight. I've had this philosophy for a long time. We cannot fight other people's wars. We cannot liberate other people unless they're willing to fight for themselves. Iraq has got to be. Iraqis have got to be totally involved in Iraq
mm-hmm.
to save Iraq. We cannot save it. Somalia would never be saved because the Somalians didn't care. The Somalians were not going to change because they didn't want to change. I don't want to say they were happy with getting donations and living off of hand-me-downs.
Mm-hmm.
But in all fairness, you didn't see anything in them moving to try to get the better themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Somalia was just, we were doing the right thing, but we were just prolonging.
Mm-hmm.
If we hadn't gone in there, maybe the warlords would have, maybe the populace would have revolted against the warlords, and maybe they got things going. I understand they're trying to get a democracy, a government going, a national government going in there now. But
right, the president now, I think is actually a former U.S. Marine.
Oh, is he
the guy who took over? Yes.
Oh, well, that might work out. I mean, the warlords were just nasty individuals. We had our chance to have, I think we got a deed one time, or one of his seconds. I think it was one of the seconds, but he was in a deed's vehicle, and we had him at one time. But that was when we were doing humanitarian, and we interviewed him, and released him.
What did you think of Black Hawk Down and then, of course, the movie?
This goes back to my thing about war movies. I don't go see war movies. I just don't feel that the movies are going to tell the truth. And there's a guy, he just started working for our sheriff's office. He was in Black Hawk Down. He was one of the Black Hawk pilots.
Wow.
And as a real veteran, he won't talk about it. You know, he said a couple of things. He said, actually, he's in the movie itself. And, and I didn't know that. And
he himself or his character?
No, he himself.
Okay.
The movie makers had, some of the, people play themselves in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But he mentioned Black Hawk Down. He says, you know, that was one battle. He says there was about 160-some other battles going on, too.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't go see the movies. I told you John Wayne is one thing because John Wayne's pro-military. John Wayne is John Wayne.
Mm-hmm.
World War II movies were pro-military, and I love watching them, but I have a real hard time watching anything after that.
So you have not seen Black Hawk Down, the movie?
No, I have not.
Okay, and I take it you have not seen We Were Soldiers?
No, I have not. I saw, when I'm stuck in a module, we have movies on Saturday night, first-run movies, as a treat for the prisoners.
Okay.
If they keep their areas clean during the week, it starts out with either with a movie that we put on the VCR. Next thing, if they really keep clean, is they get a bag of popcorn, and if they're really clean during the week, they get a glass of soda pop, because
okay.
they don't get soda in our facility.
Okay.
One night I was in a module, and we were soldiers, or whatever the name it was,
mm-hmm.
Was on. And I saw bits and pieces of it.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to my wife, Sandy, about it later, and I mentioned, you know, boy, that was in a, you know, a different type of movie. And I kind of expected, you know, and she told me, she says, well, that was a movie that was written by a soldier. That was the first conflict of Vietnam that employed all this. And I says, oh, okay. And again, I hadn't heard about it, and I stay away from the movies, I stay away from the books, and that type of thing.
Okay.
When Black Hawk Down occurred, I was really pissed. One, dragging our soldiers' bodies through the streets.
Mm-hmm.
Two, as things started coming out in the press that, you know, the military asked for things before that operation and was turned down by Washington.
Mm-hmm.
That even pissed me off more. And it just reinforced my beliefs that if you start letting civilians run, you know, run the operation, then you're not going to get the quality operation that you're supposed to have.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes back to, I have no love for President Clinton. I thought, him being a a draft dodger during Vietnam, and he didn't dodge draft, but he damn sure got out of going
mm-hmm.
and serving, and he did it in a very disrespectful way, and I just don't have any I don't care for him at all,
mm-hmm.
and when he didn't support the military, when his administration wouldn't give the tools to the military that they asked for, that just reinforced more.
Mm-hmm.
And then the things leading up before 9/11 that happened, where the USS Cole was bombed, and I wrote a letter to, and when I was in Somalia, I just gotten there, and the Clinton administration had just taken over. They had been in the news. And a civilian in the administration, a military member, general, had walked up and said, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
And the civilian person says, I don't talk to the military.
Hmm.
And walked on. It got in the press. And at first it was played down, oh, no, no, that didn't happen. And then they found the military member, and the military member said, yeah, it did happen. And I wrote a letter saying, I can't believe, you know, you allow people in your administration to continue to serve when they're treating military members like that. And I wish I had saved a copy of my letter. I didn't.
You wrote to the White House?
I wrote to the White House. I wrote to the president because he was the commander-in-chief.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
Did you get a reply?
I got a reply, and I still got that. Sandy's got it put away somewhere, but the reply was a standard letter. Thank you very much for your your interest in this subject. We really appreciate hearing from you about this, and please feel free to write us again if you care to. Type of thing. It was a standard letter.
Okay.
It wasn't, and it wasn't signed by the president or anything. And I thought, okay, that did a lot of good. And so that just cemented our feelings about it. But then when the towers were bombed, and when USS Cole mm-hmm. With bombs. And, you know, what else? Oh, the embassies in Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, nothing was done. It wasn't until the World Trade Centers were actually brought down that we finally saw the light and decided to do something. Well,
mm-hmm.
we had a totally different administration then, too. And I just, President Clinton did not impress me. He was, and I think he's probably part of the cause for 9/11.
Gary, can you tell me your feelings about the present-day war in Iraq, having already been there and served in Desert Shield and Desert Storm?
When we went into Panama, we called it Just Cause.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was a couple of reasons. One, we needed an operational name, and I think it was the right name. I think Iraq could be called Just Cause, too. Just like it was for Desert Shield, Desert Storm. It's the right thing to do. I don't want to see military members put in harm's way, but there was too much implications of weapons mass destruction. There was too much implications that he could divert those to terrorists
mm-hmm.
and come on our shores. And I thought, for those reasons, he needed to be stopped. We criticized, in after World War II, all the history books I read, and I mean, we beat ourselves up for not getting involved in World War II earlier
mm-hmm.
by saving the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all I ever heard, how terrible we were for not saving the millions of Jews that were exterminated. Saddam Hussein was the same as Hitler. I mean, he was exterminating people.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we beat ourselves up for not doing what we did in World War II, I think we were justified by just what we're hearing of what he did to his people. I heard the other day he had a, what do you call it, a chopping machine that...
Guillotine?
No, not a guillotine. It was on news that... you know what a mulching machine is, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They had mulching machines for human beings and throwing them in there live. Now, that's only one report I heard. I didn't actually see it in the news. I heard it on the radio. But if that's true, I mean, that's gone even beyond what Hitler done.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, God, I mean, just, that was, that's justified. That was just cause.
Mm-hmm.
Now, protecting the force. Things are going to happen. We're going to have losses, roadside bombings and things like that. But it seems like it's happening way more than I would have thought our force would be doing. I would have thought our force would have been more, I don't know, hardening the targets.
Mm-hmm.
Defending our targets, preventing. The other day, somebody got a car bomb inside one of the compounds. I guess there was two car bombs, and
mm-hmm.
one made it almost in through the gates and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that is almost like reliving the Lebanon barracks,
mm-hmm.
Marine barracks in
mm-hmm.
Lebanon. I don't know. It just, to me, I think the military commanders are not protecting the forces as well as they should, especially on convoys. But I'm not over there either, and
right.
it's hard to say.
Right.
You're going to have combat losses in any war,
mm-hmm.
and it just, I don't know. I think I'm wondering if military commanders are doing all they can.
Okay.
But knowing military commanders the way I do, there's no way in hell they wouldn't be doing everything they could to protect their force. I think the press is doing a hell of a job against the military. They're telling us all the bad things that are happening.
Mm-hmm.
and forgetting about the good.
Okay.
So, I think we're doing the right thing in there.
Okay. Gary, why did you choose to stay in the military for 24 years?
I joke about it 3 years at a time. Originally, I stayed in the first 3 years. My second enlistment was because I had a platoon sergeant who I really respected, and I don't think he ever knew it, but I really respected him so much that I saw a careerist, a professional, and I said, you know, this might not be a bad thing to do. So I stayed in 3 more years, and plus I got to reenlist and go where I wanted to, and I was going to be a cop. I was going to go to Fort Knox, Kentucky, and be a real MP. And I did do that, and that's why I stayed the second enlistment. After that, I enjoyed military life. I enjoyed the people I was working with. I enjoyed things. And I was just reenlisting every 3 years. I always said, you know, if I ever get fed up with this, I'll just have to, the worst I'll have to do is stay 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And until I got to 24 years. And then I was forced out. I would have stayed until, you know, till they forced me out. And they did.
How were you forced out?
As an E-8, I was not, I never got picked for promotion to E-9. Which was sergeant major, and that's the highest rank you can go. And I just was never selected. And to, as an E-8, you have to get out at after 24 years.
Okay. Okay.
So.
All right. Gary, one more question about Vietnam. Have you been to the memorial in Washington, D.C.?
I have.
Can you tell me about your experiences there?
Very moving. I really didn't think much about it until I got there, and I kind of broke down about it. I had Sandy with me and the kids, and we were in Detroit, I think, at the time when I finally made it to it.
What year was this? Do you remember?
Oh, God, no, I don't. I can't even place it.
Was it like in the last couple of years?
Oh, no. No, this was probably a couple of years after it had been built.
Okay.
It was very moving. I've been stationed in Maryland since then, and I went there a couple more times, and it is just as moving then. I went there after they put the statues up of the different soldiers and the service members.
Mm-hmm.
And that was moving as well. It was, I mean, it didn't, I had a good tour in Vietnam, but even with a good tour, you have sorrow about things, how things went.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it was just moving. That's the only way I know how to describe it.
Okay. Was there anything else that you'd like to talk about that we have not covered?
Did I talk about homecoming?
Back from Vietnam?
From Vietnam versus Panama and all of them?
We did not compare them.
Okay.
Why don't you go ahead?
Yeah. When I came back from Vietnam, I think I mentioned this. I was in the San Francisco airport, and I felt like I was being looked at.
Mm-hmm.
And I probably was paranoid because we had always been told, oh, yeah, you're going to be called baby killers when you come back.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I never had anybody approach me or tell me I was a baby killer or anything like that. But I felt I did feel like I was being stared at. I was in uniform.
Mm-hmm.
When I got home to Indianapolis, my brother, little brother, and my sister and her family were there to welcome me home at the airport.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a good feeling. I was very pleased. I was relieved. I remember laying in bed that night and couldn't sleep because that was the first night I'd been in a bed, and I felt safe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I felt that nothing could happen. Coming back from Just Cause, we flew in at something like 12. We got in probably about 12 o'clock. We had to fly into Dover, which was kind of funny because we flew into Dover, and we were so close to other military air bases
mm-hmm.
at Fort Meade. But we flew into Dover, and then from Dover, we were bused in a long bus ride, and everybody had a chance to sit around and say what they were going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And guys were talking about, well, I'm going to Denny's. I'm going to get a decent cup of coffee and stay up past 11 o'clock at night
mm-hmm.
because everything's shut down pretty much in Panama at night
mm-hmm.
Until right at the end. And when we got there, we had nobody knew what to expect. I mean, when I got back from Vietnam, there was nothing. When we got back, there was a band playing. And there was a lot of people there.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy. And it was really a good thing. My wife was there with, I want to say my daughter or my son. I think my son was there.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my dogs. And the funny thing was, it was like the dog realized I was home.
Really?
And just jumping up and down and everything else. But the band was playing.
Mm-hmm.
The military, garrison commander was there to welcome us back. I mean, it was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't, you know, if you ever saw another movie I watched, and only because I wasn't in the conflict, is Clint Eastwood's Heartbreak Ridge.
Yes.
At the end, one of the Marines says, well, this is old hat for you, Eddie. And he says, to tell you the truth, this is the first time. Well, that's the way it was for me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like I said in the music, they played in Saudi. It was a new experience. Coming back from Desert Storm, it was the same thing, only we were in an auditorium in a gymnasium.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, the press was there, the garrison commander again. A big to-do, formation, the whole bit.
Mm-hmm.
I was even on TV with tears running down my eyes of
really?
All things. And it was, I was interviewed, and the interview was never shown on TV, but in one of the news clips, I'm shown wearing my boonie hat and in my desert camis, tears rolling down my eyes. And it says, the news commentator says something like, even not only the spouse or the family members have tears in their eyes. And I'm thinking, oh, great. Yeah. This is not a good picture of a tough sergeant. And I got a copy. Somebody who I didn't even know, who knew that we were coming back and was a friend of the father of one of my daughter's friends,
mm-hmm.
Taped everything that was being televised about that homecoming.
Right.
And so I got video of that. And you guys will get all that, too.
Okay.
And then when we got back from Somalia, which was a little bit different, I was asked to hold over into Somalia with the battalion commander, the plans officer, and I want to say there was four of us,
mm-hmm.
three officers and me. And I was asked, would I stay back with them and when the battalion moved back to Fort Hood? And I said I would.
Mm-hmm.
When we got back, we had to fly back with our guns in our duffel bags. No, I take it back. I guess we didn't come back with guns because we were borrowing weapons from the unit that we were supporting.
Mm-hmm.
So, but we had duffel bags, and we had to travel in our BDUs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I am so happy for the guys from Iraq getting cheered, you know, on the plane. I heard that when they're coming back for their R&R, they're still in their BDUs and they're flying on civilian aircraft, and people are standing up to cheer.
Mm.
And that's good. Well, we flew into all the airports, and not a whole lot of taboo made about it. You know, you felt kind of out of place because we're in those camis.
Mm-hmm.
We got to the airport and in F Killeen, and there was a small group there to welcome us home, and they were the guys that had preceded us, left Somalia before us, and my wife was there, and it was a nice homecoming. But the first one, Just Cause, that had to be the best. I mean, was not expecting that at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a real good homecoming. So that's about it on the homecoming.
Okay. All right. Is there anything else that you'd like to discuss, Gary?
I don't think so. I think that pretty much hits it all.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll go ahead and end the interview with Mr. Gary Smith. Thank you so much for your time, sir.
Hey, no problem, Richard. Thank you.